Okay, thank you very much indeed. It is a privilege to be here. I'm aware that I'm going to share numbers with you and ideas with you which you probably haven't come across before, and you may want to resist and not include, but I'm passionate about trying to get these ideas through you to all the young people that need to know. Beyond my career, because I've been retired for some time, but one is allowed in the world of university to have the emeritus title, and so one can continue. I've moved from recognizing that water is a very interesting topic, and you can talk about the hydrological cycle, and I'm sure you share that with all your people. But I've moved from recognizing that water as a science and as a water management challenge is subordinate to food. So the message today is, and it's to some extent confirmed in today's I, the independent short version. There are a couple of articles in there, one about food and one about farming, which are going to be major themes. And I'm very pleased that other newspapers I read, such as The Guardian, have very good material on food, less good material on water. So, but what we need, if we're going to help young people and society in general, help farmers to do the right thing, because they manage most of the 92%. We need to get across them that it's what they choose to eat, waste and misconsume through becoming obese and throwing stuff away and consuming food you don't need to eat are all clearly part of the unsustainable way that we are running things. So it's a wonderful topic, I think. So who manages water? Water in food supply chains is the theme. A food supply chain is something which I wish, when I first came across geography 50 years ago or more, we'd been thinking food supply chains or supply chains in general, because they're so easy to get across. They've got a beginning with farmers and an end with consumption. But it's easy. It's a story, a narrative. You don't have to worry about getting across. Everyone can see it easily. So food supply chains and the role of farmers who manage 90% of the 92% is managed by farmers. And we want them to do it sustainably. I took a few seconds to look at GCSE aims and objectives to try and indicate that I was a responsible speaker that cared about things from your point of view. And I came across things such as aims and objectives, concepts which illuminate processes and their significance in a range of locational contexts. Well, we'll be talking about that a bit today. Complexity of people and environment, which is clearly geography, and this is a wonderful way into analyzing that. We have enough metrics to do it, as well as enough concepts and ideas. And some of the key issues facing the world today, so it's really a relevant topic. It needs to be thought about in the relationship between food and water and energy, but we're just today going to be looking at the food and water aspect of that. There is a movement globally, the World Bank, the World Economic Forum, the US State Department, GIZ, and a whole lot of other organizations in the world at this point of 2015 are very interested in what they call the nexus between water, energy, and food, which is something which, if you ever want to talk about, I can give you, but we're not going to have time to do that today. We're just going to do the water and food part. So in addition, we're going to look at these issues because water and food are definitely to do with all of these issues. Now, one thing I notice in there, and it's been a great problem in my life as well, that in education we don't tend to talk about politics, but food is elementally politicized. Water also, but not quite as much, but food is elementally politicized. If we pretend it isn't, we're missing the point. So I don't know how you're steered as a profession about politics, but by not getting people to realize that this is, you know, the power of the big corporates, the power or not of governments. These are all essential issues which I'll try to highlight as we go through. So, and also to improve the understanding of which values, attitudes, and circumstances. So today is a value-laden talk, because do people value water? You value the water in the tap, you're prepared to pay $1, $2, $3, $4 a cubic meter for water in the tap, you're prepared to pay $500, $1,000 in some places for the water on the table per cubic meter. But you don't want to pay, you don't want to have the farmers pay anything for the water that they use, and they use 90% of 92%. That's got to be free. Nature can't be protected from our greed to have the water so that we can have the food. So it's a massively interesting, and the reason we can't have that is because we want cheap food. Now, cheap food is, again, a breathtakingly politicized issue. You can see how Tesco and Morrison's at the moment are actually talking about cheap food again. They stopped talking about it for 10 years because it's cheap is not the right word, but they've been using it in the last 5 months because of the shock of the change in price of oil and the change in the price of food. So I would argue that today's material is totally relevant to people and to geography at this point in its history. I noticed on page 6 that this was mentioned, the carbon cycle and the water cycle. I did for a few sort of 10 minutes or so think about trying to talk about both, but decided it would complicate matters too much, so I'm just going to talk about the water cycle, and I could on another occasion, as I say, talk about the carbon cycle and how we're trying to get people to think about these things together. So the purpose of the session is to highlight the significance of farmers and other players in food supply chains. As I said, 92% of the water consumed in an economy is embedded in our food. Most of the 92%, at least 90% of that 92% is consumed on farm. The difference between, by the way, the word use, which in Danny Dawling's, the word use is mentioned, consumption is the important word, because the water at home and the water in industry, we can normally reuse in places like Singapore and Israel, 50-70% is reused. So that those small amounts of water, the 8%, most of it can be recycled at a cost. But if we are paying $2, $3, $4 a cubic meter, we are prepared to put a few more dollars into cleaning it up because it's where we need it. It's going to be reused. So I say farmers consume and steward water on behalf of us, society, on behalf of the children and young people that you're helping learn. They do it in food supply chain with governments, consumers and corporates having to deliver cheap food because that's politically essential. In the United States, they have a farm bill in which $76 billion a year out of a total agricultural farm bill of $100 billion a year, $76 billion is on food stamps to give cheap, free food to people that aren't being paid a living wage. You can see how locked we are into the politics of cheap food. And farmers, the production side of things, have somehow got all of this weight upon them. So cheap food prices do not reflect the value or the costs of providing water. It's free. You take it from the environment for nothing. So, but on the other hand, in the way of things, we need farmers to be good stewards of water ecosystems at this point in history when the demand for food and fiber continues to rise. So we need to know about and understand the role of the private sector, because the food supply chain is all in the private sector. Farmers are private sector people, traders are private sector people, food processors are private sector people, supermarkets are private sector people, consumers are private sector people. And if we pretend it's not like that, then we're missing the point, although governments clearly, as I'll show, do have a big role to play as well. So I'd love you to get all of this across to the young and the not so young people that you share time with. So we're going to, especially the role of demand for food, the families of the people that you're helping learn. Farmers manage water and food consumers determine the demand for water. We need to distinguish, as far as I'm concerned, something which we've never done before, food water and non-food water, because food water is 92% and non-food water is 8%. I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. So will there be enough water is something we're 7 billion going on, 7 billion now, 9 billion by 2050, let's say, more calories and meat, fish and milk consumption, more food production needed. If you're an optimist like me, I would say about 40%, but some pessimists say 100%. So it's a nuisance. I'm despite having a very important message, I'm an optimist. I feel that we do have the capacity, if we educate people properly, to make the right choices in food consumption and not waste it. We can, in fact, deliver a sustainable system and just have to increase by 40%. By the way, all these numbers are, despite an awful lot of people thinking very deeply, I wouldn't like to come back in 20 years' time and have to prove that I was right. I'm part of a community of people that are trying to make the educated guesses. So we need more food, more water for food via sustainable intensification. That's a whole lecture in itself. We'll not deal with that today. Pessimists are wrong, but useful. So I should be a pessimist to really get your attention, and you may find yourself having to be a pessimist if you're going to get this across in the classroom. Optimists are right, but dangerous. So an optimist, I think I'm right. Because I'm saying, you know, if we're sensible, we can get there. If everyone then relaxes, oh, well, someone else is going to be sensible. We perhaps don't have to be sensible. So just to try and get across some of the proportions and the general background on water and energy, this is, for the next few slides, I'm going to mention energy just to make a comparison. Water supply chains and energy supply chains, the types of water, natural and manufactured, we can have non-renewable water, that is water in fossil aquifers in the middle of the Sahara and the Arabian, or beneath the Arabian desert. That's a very small proportion of the water actually consumed by humanity. Whereas on the energy side, six types of really big battalion. these three are the majority energy sources. There are three of them competing with each other, in a sense, or substituting one for the other. Substitution on the water side is not so easy. On the renewable water side, which is what we really care about, we've got something which I call green water, and more people are calling it green water. That's the water in the soil profile. That's at least if it's this much, if it's that much over the season, you can grow a good crop with that. If you have twice as much as that, you can get two crops, not in this country because you've got a bad winter, but in sensible Mediterranean climates and other climates, you can get two crops a year if you've got a meter depth of water. But in the green water, we've only got what the gods send as rainfall, and that's not accounted at all. So you go from here saying green water is the most important water because it's the majority water. It's not true, actually, because blue water has got some qualities which green water doesn't have. You can pump green blue water around and substitute it and add it and do clever things with it. So the opportunity value of blue water is higher. In these boxes, by the way, they're all the same size. I haven't had time to develop the slide to show the actual volume of green water, but I'm going to show that in a moment. So we've got green water and renewable blue water. That's the stuff that comes down the rivers, is in the ponds and lakes, and it can also, of course, be underground water. We then have manufactured water, which is desalinated water and treated blue water, recycled water. It's very important in some economies, I said, Singapore and Israel, but it's a very tiny volume of water at the global scale. It's very crucial in some economies, and we will need some of that in this country, because I'm going to shock you in a moment, unless you've read the stuff that I sent around to be circulated. We in this country are a deficit economy. We don't have enough water. Although we think we have a lot of water, we in fact don't, because we can't feed ourselves. So, but on the renewable side, on energy, you can see you've got all of these. By the way, it was pointed out to me that nuclear is perhaps a renewable resource. It's obviously you can run out of the fuel, but you can in fact reuse it, and it almost becomes a renewable resource. So as you can see, so the world of water is very limited substitution, because you've got not many types of water to substitute, whereas there's lots of substitution and competition. So if you're any of you economic geographers, you know that substitution is one of the sort of three most fundamental things for an economist. Just to put this in a time context, the previous and new development eras, from 1850-ish to round about now, water use in irrigation is a relevant indicator of what we call the hydraulic mission, that is, using more and more water to meet the demands of more and more users. Population has gone up from 1 billion in 1800 to 7 billion now, and then it'll be 9 billion. So we've had a demand which is reflected in this indicative trajectory. By the 19th century, you know, the Enlightenment had come, science, capitalism, belief that nature could be controlled was all part of a northwestern European science and culture, and off we went and mobilized more and more water, especially in the United States in the late 19th and then through the 20th century until about 1970, which is about here. So we had this pre-modern period, and then we had industrial modernity, when all of the good things from here were piled in and enabled us to do that. And during that period, we were certain that we were doing the right thing. Yeah. Engineers, you know, enabled this to happen. Engineers were the agents of politicians. You know, if a politician had a food problem or a water problem, an engineer was there to say, this is the solution, we can provide it. And so the relationship between the wonderful engineering profession and the political necessities was so close, and it seemed to be proved to be the case until the Green Movement came along in the 1950s and 60s and said, hey, I was around at this time, and I wasn't part of the Green Movement, I'm very ashamed to say, despite being a geographer. The geographers didn't do enough. It was the activists, certainly academic geographers, didn't do anything. They just rejoiced in the environment going up and up the agenda. It's still not as high as it should be, but they've got a job. And in some ways, perhaps it also reflects in the schools that geography and the environment, or the environment, is so important that it needs the people to be talking about it. Anyway, we moved from this certainty to uncertainty. And as a consequence of that, there was a sort of tipping point around about here. If you remember, Jimmy Carter was president here, and the Green people got to him and said, you know, we should stop building dams because they're a waste of money at this point. We've built all we need, and they're going to cost more than we thought, and it's really a no-brainer. We've got to stop. So he tried. But then, as I said, politics is the only thing that counts. He then went onto the Hill and said, what we need is to have no more dams. And then the senators and the people from the West who had been waiting 8 years for their dam, because the American Constitution is that the Washington budget can be, you know, can build military installations, arms factories, and dams, and that's the way that a senator or a governor gets his gets the resources from Washington back to their state. So this was something set up by Roosevelt inadvertently in the 1930s, and it was kept going way beyond its useful life. And although Jimmy Carter failed, when his successor Reagan came in, who was a very different sort of politician, a very right-wing politician. In fact, he implemented everything that Jimmy Carter had suggested, which was to have this trajectory here. Having lived through this transition from certainty to uncertainty and risk awareness, which we have currently, it was very big in the 90s and the 80s and the 90s, and it's still pretty well going strong. Risk is a terribly important word in markets and people that analyze and try to get attention. So we went through, as I remember, because I was quite a busy person in the game at that time, we had in this, so this was industrial modernity, this is what we call reflexive modernity, listening to other voices coming in. And the first decade of that we had these three other paradigms. We had a green one, which was about the environment. It's for some reason it came first. In the 90s, we had an economic, and water is an economic resource. We need to value it. We still don't, so that message hasn't got across yet. We do it at home and in factories, but not in food. And then we're now in this fifth paradigm, which is about political and institutional processes and lifting awareness and trying to get society to do the right thing and to help farmers to do the right thing. So we've got a contradiction, however, in thinking about OECD economies, advanced 40 to 50 or so economies that are OECD economies. Then we've got five BRICS, but some of those coming up economies, and then the developing economies. The BRICS economies are still tending to do this, as certainly developing economies would like to, if China or some other organization will provide them with the capital to put in the infrastructure. So you can see that if you're in the World Bank trying to help these people with a message which is like this, it's been a very, very interesting time, the past 20, 30 years for the professionals in agencies such as the bank. So the thing that I can plot onto that is, which water were we aware of throughout this period? Well, I think you've come into the room fully aware of this water, and I'm saying, hey, but, in real terms, the real world, the green water is significantly, by volume, the majority water. That's producing food. You can't do anything else with green water but produce food or nice environments and so on. The proportion of water which is traded is the water which I identified as virtual water, water that it takes to to raise a ton of something. It takes 1,000 tons, cubic meters of water to raise a ton of wheat. It takes 16,000 to raise a ton of beef. So you can see the contradiction in that. If we've moved to having an awful lot of beef in our diet, we're certainly going to increase our water footprint. And the difference between a veggie's water footprint and a big beef eater's water footprint is that the big beef eater is 5 cubic meters a day, as opposed to a veggie, which is just 2.5. So it's a very big metric, a very big number. And then if you think about it, five cubic meters per person per day if you're a big beef eater, and it's 2.5 if you're a veggie. But if you think about the water footprint of yourselves at work, it's 5 cubic meters a year. Because all the water you use at work is a few cups of coffee, flush the loo, and wash your hands. So if you can convert, if you can have lots of people doing teaching, police work, and all the other stuff in the public sector, as well as people serving in cafes, in other words, urban life, provided there's someone out there producing the food, there are livelihoods in the cities and towns so that they can buy the food. But what we need to do is to educate the people buying and choosing the food to be aware that they depend on the green water, the green water which produces most of it. I could give a long talk about irrigation and so on, but there isn't time. Just to give a flavour of this, this is some work done on Kenya, and this is the rainfall, and then we find that the vast majority of the water is evapotranspiring in the savannah, in forests and woodlands. I think about 80% of the water is here, and 20% is elsewhere. So green water is very important indeed. Now, how do we allocate, use, consume, and deplete water and energy in private sector supply value chains? I've introduced the idea of the supply value chains, the food supply chain, the energy supply chain, and even the water and sewage supply chain, which gives us our water at home. So we've now introduced a comparison with energy, but that isn't the main theme of the day. So on the food water side, to produce food and fiber, we have the green water, the blue water, and irrigation, not much in this country, only 5% of the UK arable area is equipped with irrigation, and in any one year only 3% is actually irrigated, so it's a very tiny amount of water. And where we do irrigate, that's where we run out of water. Any of you come from Lincolnshire or Cambridgeshire or Norfolk, that's where we irrigate, and that's always, when we have a drought, where we have the tightest problems with water. Because we, spreading water a meter deep or half a meter deep or even just 10 inches deep is a huge amount of water. There's no other economic activity uses so much. So 90%, when I did this, the work to say 92% hadn't been done. And I always felt it was easier to say 90 and 10, so you could go away and say 90%, 10%. You can see that in the food and fiber, food water side, we've got 90%. On the non-food side, industry, domestic and other things, we've got 8 or 9%, say 10%. So that's a revelation I trust that you will not forget and that you will now communicate to whoever you're trying to help to understand water. So a half a billion farmers worldwide manage that water for us without us being prepared to give them a livelihood which is secure and safe. So it's stupid, is it not? But on the energy side, you can see that we've got the opposite asymmetry and quite an interesting pair of numbers. On the farming and the food supply chain, uses about 20% of energy, but domestic uses a lot of water, industry uses the water, and transport here uses a lot of energy. So you can see it's not easy to compare water and energy because where they consume is rather different. So will there be enough water? Well, yes, I'm optimistic. This is the record since 1961 through to around about, 2005 in that case. You can see that 1 liter of water produces one calorie on average, and this is the number of calories produced as a trend since 1961, a bit of a faltering in the 80s, but now we're back on a different trend. And you can see the trend for the world has been usefully positive. Asia has been very, very wonderful, and that's important because there are 1.3 billion people in China and 1.2 going on 1.8 in India in due course. So we need Asia to be self-sufficient or producing enough. India is still a net exporter of food. It's very bad for its environment, but it's still a net exporter of food. And you can see sub-Saharan Africa has an immense potential if it could emulate what has happened elsewhere. And of course, we've had these dramatic changes in yield. This is the United States. This is maize, I think, maize yield. And you can see since the middle of the last century, the maize yields have dramatically increased by 5 times or so. In China, they've also blessed China, they've been going up. And in sub-Saharan Africa, in Latin America, bless Brazil, they're going up, but in sub-Saharan Africa, not. So clearly, sub-Saharan Africa is an issue. We need it to be doing this to not only feed its doubled population from going from 1 to 2 billion, we need it perhaps to be providing food for the rest of the world because it has the environment potentially to do that. Just looking at the picture globally, this is the total water footprint in different parts of the world. That's a nice geographical thing to spend an afternoon on. And my idea of virtual water explains why, with just 15% of the world's food traded, we don't have any problems. We can be optimistic, provided, as I'll show in a moment, we're not drying, pulling too much water out of here, and have not yet pulled too much out of here, but we might be tending to be tempted to, and we need to get this area to obviously operate more effectively. An interesting little story about identifying the concept of something that I called originally embedded water, because it sounded the right word to use. It was the water embedded in food, in its production and processing and delivery to the consumer. I found, however, that the... Why did I discover it? It's because in the introduction, I have worked most of my life in the Middle East, where it's clearly a water-scarce area. And if they had somehow survived 50 years of things getting progressively more difficult, because more of the population was doubling every 30 years and they weren't producing very much more food. And it gradually dawned on me as I was working in Egypt in the late 70s, early 80s, and then later on, especially in the middle 80s, I spotted that the way that Egypt solved its problem was to import food, because clearly food, at that stage we hadn't done water footprinting, we didn't have all the metrics, but I could see that all you did was import food. So that, but I was originally trying to answer the question, why is there no armed conflict over water in this region where palpably they've run out? Everyone knows they've run out, although no one politician would actually say it. It's evident that they've run out. But why, if we know that if something as elemental as water is not available, affecting food availability, why? Well, it's because the global system can easily deliver food. So I then realized that what we had here was the solution to a global problem, which was most areas of the world, including all the European countries except France and Poland, are very the food deficit economies. So 28 or 29, or whatever number it is, of European economies have been, as I'll show in a moment, dependent on the Americas for their food and water security. So it's normal. So 28 countries in Europe, and then another 20 countries in the Middle East. So that's 50 countries out of 210 or 15. There are that number in the world. So it's there are 50 countries in here that are all extremely water deficit economies. It doesn't, the world doesn't stop, it doesn't, it's because we've got the private sector providing food in circumstances which are not good for farmers. So that's a lot in those two slides, I would suggest. Now this one I think is the star slide. If you take this away and show it to your people, I can spend an hour on this, but I'll only spend 2 minutes. You can spend perhaps an afternoon. But this is the food surplus and deficits. We're talking about the 15% of traded food. And we've got some star performers in North America. Each of these is 5 years. So this is the trajectory since 1965 to around about now. And you can see how North America has done its stuff globally, and the majority of the 15% of traded food has been coming out of North America until South America. This is a star performer, and it can do that. Now this is going to do that, possibly that. This is going to do that. These are very important ideas, very important metrics. Generated by Cargill in the private sector, because there are four big grain traders in the world. ABCD makes it easy to remember. ADM is an American company. Bunge is an American company, Cargill is an American company, and Dreyfus is a French company. And they handle 70% of the 15% of the by volume of the world food traded. They're very, very powerful, very well informed. Still a private family company. ADM and Bunge are now have annual meetings, so you can actually get to ask them questions. But Cargill is still under the table, invisible, with huge power and very close relations with the US government. Australia has been doing proud things. It's not got a lot of water, but it's got very few people, so it's got, therefore, a surplus of water. Eastern Europe is the other. This is the star performer. This is the other one. This is really important stuff. Look what Russia and Ukraine have done since 1965. You know, they were in the deficit now and going up. So that's... If you want to know what's happening in Ukraine, ask Cargill, because part of that process that has brought this around. Central America is a bit of a problem. Doesn't show any signs of being able to get out of its problems any more than Europe. I was shocked until I saw this diagram because this is the trajectory that I'd been aware of from my childhood in the 50s and the 50s, 40s and the 50s. I knew that we were, a 60% food importer. We only were 40% self-sufficient by volume. That's related very closely to water availability or how we could mobilize water. It was the work of WWF, which I've circulated. They found when they did their work at this point that instead of continuing to do that, what Western Europe has done is that. We've fallen back into our 19th century habit of relying on North America for our food. Extraordinary. So this is something to tell people sitting comfortably in the cities of England, that we depend on other people for our food because they have surplus water. Asia is obviously a problem. India is, in fact, a net food exporter, but China has come on the market, and Indonesia and other places are also major food importers. The Middle East is, unfortunately making this complicated because Africa has the potential to do this, whereas the Middle East can only do that. Anyway, that's a wonderful diagram to spend an afternoon on. You can see how we've got our trends, wonderful news here and here, stupid news here. What are we? We've got to do something about this. Asia problem, Middle East a problem, Africa a development problem. So we've got good news and very good news. These people are exporting their environments, and the Americans may decide that they don't want to do that. At the moment they do, but they may decide not to. we are not prepared to be so careless with our environments, but the Americans have a choice. South America, we hope, will continue to do that, although it will clearly reach a point where it thinks we mustn't export so much of our environment. Australia has already got that idea in mind, and we need to help Africa to perhaps move over here. So lots of stuff in that diagram, I think, very important. Food prices, again, I dare say this isn't something you want to talk about, but it's a key issue because we want cheap food. Consumers want cheap food. Governments want to give old people like me cheap food because there are an awful lot of us and, we vote. And so the government's state is in a terrible fix. It can't stand up and say, you've got to pay the full price for food, and that's got to include the environmental cost, because it doesn't even get on the never gets on the speech agenda. So, the other thing that's again something to conjure to get across to your young people is that. Food prices aren't rising, they are, over time, they're falling. So this trajectory, I was young enough at this point, to 1973 and then 78, 9, you know, this happened. And I remember when we got down here, I thought, surely we're going to do sensible things and, you know, do the right thing by the environment and have properly priced food. We've lost 40 years. No, the power, this is why politics is elementally important and overrides everything. Everything that you're talking about as environmental scientists and geographers, trying to get it into the debate, is nothing compared with the power of the consumer and the pleasing of the consumer by cheap food. So we've now been here, and one of the things that obsessed me, I don't know if anyone isn't, this is the diagram we get currently. They forget what was happening. So they said, we're not in that. We're in a position where no one really knows. But that was the trajectory until 2000, because oil prices kicked off. And these are very much related to energy prices, oil price spikes. You can see that in 2003, the oil price started to kick off, and the food prices have tracked that. We had the peak in 2008 and 2011, and now we're coming down. Now, I drew this diagram first in October when I was in Washington talking to one of the big traders, Bunge, and I said to Carl Hausman, who's someone I know there, I said, Carl, I think the prices are going to continue to fall, like as they did here, because there's nothing changed in the politics. Everyone still wants cheap food. And so he said, yes, what he thought was that there would be a fall in price, and at some point it would stop, let's say here, and then the trajectory would continue, not at such a steep rate, but at this rate. This is being discussed in FAO and OECD and other places in the International Food Research Center. And they feel that we are now in a period, after a long period of stable prices, although they've, in fact, food prices have been falling for 1,000 years, not just for the past 60 years. Anyway, by the time I got back to London and then December had come, of course, we'd got to this position, and it's now June, and we're now in a position where, you know, the prices are falling again. You can see how, as I said, Tesco and Morrison's are locked in competing down the price of food. Yet they're the people that have the contracts with the farmers. So it's a lovely lot of stuff to help people know about. So who will save the world? Just three or four more slides. If you just put the food supply chain, as I said at the beginning, the food supply chain is easy to get into people's, you know, everyone gets it straight away. We start with farmers, and then we've got people that operate water infrastructures, perhaps big ag seed organizations, big ag fertilizer chemical corporates, big food commodity traders, ABCDs, big food and beverage corporates, Nestle, Unilever, big supermarkets, the other major food distributors, the state, including law and regulation, accountants who don't, unfortunately, have a voice in food water very much. We've got investors who ought to be sustainably investing, encouraging these people to do the right thing. Food and water NGOs who've done a hell of a lot, local and international. So most of the stuff that I distributed was generated by NGOs. They've done more than science. They get science and then they project it. You get science, I hope, and project it to lots and lots of people. Multi and bilateral aid agencies, consumers, and society, that's us and the young people that you relate to. So if you then think about power, who has power in the current supply chains? You can see farmers, bless them, who manage 90% of the 92% of water. You know, they've got no power. They are subject to contracts which are written by these people, especially with the big supermarkets and with these people. The state is, as I've discovered during the past 3 or 4 years of research, my little interjection about the farm bill in the United States, it was $76 billion a year. $76 billion is bigger than 130 economies in the world. So that's just the food stamps in the United States, in terms of dollar terms, is bigger than 150 economies worldwide. So the state is a very important subsidizing, steering policy, public policy making outfit. Accountants should be regulating us and them to value water, but they don't. The food and water NGOs, perhaps they shouldn't. They don't have power, but they do have impact. And the aid agencies have less impact than they should. The consumers, us and your young people that you can relate to, breathtakingly important. They don't realize it. Society, by adopting sound behavior, where is that? So now this is who will secure water and food for society. Well, clearly farmers will. Society, by adopting sound behavior, that's where all of this is about. Society, the young people that you're dealing with, will become society, and what they do in terms of choosing the right food and not throwing it away is a terribly important thing. So consumers, including your students, are very important. The state will always be important, and we need to somehow contain, in my view, I respect highly what they've delivered. They've delivered a solution, but it's not a sustainable solution. And because we can't get the accountants to put accounting rules in here to get them to account for water, we can't get what we as society wants. But we won't get that until we start to get investors. Where are the investors? Investors, yeah. So we need to target these people, to discipline these people, because investors do in fact steer corporations into perhaps the right way. So that's it. Farmers, water, society, the young people that you connect with, and the messages that are part of a good suite of ideas with respect to geography lessons in the next 5 years. Thank you.